Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Alexander McCall Smith brings to life a whole world in Africa, Botswana, with his number one ladies detective agency series, strong female characters, and criminal capers filled with wit and life wisdom. But McCall Smith brings other worlds to life as well, this time out rural England in the harrowing midst of World War II. And the power of music to pull people through. This hour, On Point, Alexander McCall Smith and La's Orchestra saves the world. You can join the conversation. Are you an Alexander McCall Smith reader? What draws you in to his Botswana beyond? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Edinburgh, Scotland, is Alexander McCall Smith, best-selling author with more than 60 books out, from medical textbooks to children's stories to several very successful series. The number one ladies detective agency books, the Isabel D'Aloise series, the Portuguese Irregular Verbs series, he cranks them out. His newest book is La's Orchestra Saves the World. Alexander McCall Smith, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom.
You are prodigious in your output. How do you decide which of your many sort of themes and subjects and series you'll dip into when you dive into a new book, sir?
Well, to a certain extent, it's decided by other people, in the sense that we have a number of series running, and therefore keeping them going requires that a book in each of these series be written each year. So I'm not really given much freedom of choice. It's all set out for me. I know which part of the year I'm going to write which book in.
Your publishers have a lot to do with your schedule, then. I was kind of astonished I guess I could have figured it out, but the first number one ladies detective agency book by that title came out only in 1998. There's so many now, and they seem sort of timeless, like they've been around forever. These must have changed your life. They're so popular.
Well, thank you for what you said. Yes, they did. The first book was published in Scotland in a very small edition in 1998. That was the number one ladies detective agency itself, the first book in that series. And it was a very small print run, and I thought that that would be it. But I was asked to write a sequel, and the books at that stage were still very small. They didn't have a very large readership, so I wrote a sequel, and then I wrote a third volume. And then what happened was very interesting, and it's a reason why I'm eternally grateful to my American readers. The books were imported into the United States. They weren't published in the United States at that stage. They were just imported. Mm. And they went to various smaller bookstores. And they began to catch on. And people passed them from hand to hand. And then the New York Times wrote an article about the books. And I was approached by American publishers in New York. And so the books really had their first big publication, so to speak, in the United States. So it was rather a reversal of the usual thing that happens where somebody's published, an author is published in his or her own country first, and then if the books work there, they might go to the other. But in this case, it was back to front. But I was very, very grateful and remain grateful to my American readers for discovering the books. I think had it not been for them, then there wouldn't have been much beyond those first two or three books.
Many will know you from the number one ladies detective agency. Others may know you books. Others may know you from the HBO series built off of those. But I wish you'd introduce yourself just a little further. I mean, how is it that you've got one foot in Scotland as a professor of medical law and ethics at the University of Edinburgh, and obviously another foot deeply planted in Africa? Give us your personal history there.
Well, I was born in what is now Zimbabwe, and I spent my entire childhood there. It was the tail end of the colonial era. And then I went to university in Scotland. My father originally from Scotland, mm-hmm. and so at that stage the family effectively left that part of the world. And so I was back in Scotland, and I I suppose I obviously was always aware of and appreciated the African experience that I had had as a child. But it wasn't until a bit later on that I had the opportunity to go back and spend a bit of time in that part of Africa. And that was in 1980 when I went and worked for a year at the University of Swaziland. And then the following year, I went and worked in Botswana. Returned to Scotland, but that had rekindled my interest in that part of the world. And thereafter, I continued to go to Botswana every year. I had various projects there, and I'd spend a small part of each year there. And it became really very important to me. I discovered more about the country. I realised what a remarkable country it was. I very much liked the people. I greatly admired Botswana. It really is an admirable country. And then, many years later, I found myself writing a play about the place. I hadn't thought at that stage that I would write at such great length about Botswana, but I ended up writing the series of books in Botswana and or about Botswana, and it just carried on from there.
You know, it's a charming series. I'm trying to figure out exactly what is the discrete charm here. You know, in a way, people describe you as an heir to P.J. Woodhouse. You've got strong women characters here. They're not exactly mysteries. They're sort of life stories. USA Today quotes a well-known bookseller in my backyard, Jane Jacobs at Porter Square Books in Cambridge, saying that they're lady reading, but not chick lit and not old lady lit reading.
Right.
How do you describe the ladies' detective agency series, the heart of it? Is this sort of quasi? I mean, it's very modern in some ways, but there is some kind of colonial nostalgia in the attitude at the same time. What's going on in the appeal?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure whether I'm the best person to sum them up, because I think it's often quite difficult for an author to speak about his work.
Are you channeling Woodhouse when you write?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've read a bit of Woodhouse. I'm not a great. Well, I would say that I wasn't a great fan of Woodhouse, which is wrong. I do like Woodhouse, but I haven't really read everything that Woodhouse wrote, and I can't remember when I last read Woodhouse. Mm. I would say that as far as literary influences are concerned, I'm perhaps a little bit more influenced by a wonderful Indian writer called R.K. Narayan, who wrote a marvellous series of books set in an Indian town called Malgudi. Mm. And I think that I have a very great personal literary debt to R.K. Narayan, and I think there was that sort of influence. But if you're trying to find out what the core of these books, the number one ladies detective agency series, is, I would say that they're really about a society which is quite a gentle society. It's rather an interesting society. It's a very courteous and restrained society, Botswana, and it's about a very nice woman who lives in that society. It's about the life of this woman who's known a certain amount of hardship and distress, but has these marvellous values, very positive values. These books are not bleak. They're about positive things, and I don't really apologise for writing that. Sometimes people say to me, "Oh well, you know, you're writing about a very sunny side of life," and I would say yes, but that exists. That exists alongside the more negative side of things. So they're about a woman who's immensely attractive in her approach to life. She's a woman who believes in forgiveness. She's a woman who has got a sense of humour, and I think people rather like spending time in the company of such a person. And people also rather like the idea that there is a little space somewhere where people treat one another with concern and consideration, and where life isn't really, I suppose, distorted by violence and aggression and all these things that we seem to get so much of in our entertainment these days.
And this time out, in La's Orchestra Saves the World, you're carving out that sort of reserve of concern and consideration in the middle of World War II. That's a tall order. That's a tough challenge.
Right. Well, Maybe it is, but I think I wasn't around during World War II, but what I know of it and what I've read and heard about life in England in particular, I'm writing about England, which is a bit of a departure for me because I tend to write about Scotland or other places, but life there was actually, I suppose, people were under great pressure, and yet they carried on with their day-to-day lives, and they did so with dignity and with extraordinary resilience. And I think that that's something which really interests me, how people can continue to be good in very, very trying circumstances. And, of course, what people put up with during that time brought out in them often extraordinary levels of personal heroism, not just the people who were engaged in fighting, but also people who were just playing a role on the home front, so to speak. The central character in this book, La, is a woman who ends up working on a hen farm. She looks after the chickens, and that, in a sense, is her war work. But it was war work which was important, and it had a dignity to it. And so it's looking at what might seem to be a rather small life against a background of amazing events.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Alexander McCall Smith, author of the number one Ladies Detective Agency series about life, Africa, music, war, and his new book, La's Orchestra Saves the World. Behind us right here, a little bit of Billy Cotton, the British band leader and entertainer popular during World War II. It's a wartime song about defeating Adolf Hitler. Adolf, you've bitten off more than you can chew. But the heroine of McCall Smith's new book is more into Bach and Mozart. We'll talk about it. Do you know the work of Alexander McCall Smith? What's the charm of his work? How does he draw us into the ladies' detective stories in Africa? And are you ready to follow him into World War II in the English countryside? Alexander McCall Smith joins us from Edinburgh, Scotland. And tell us, what does your heroine, La, set out to do with her amateur orchestra in Suffolk?
Well, what she does is she gets together various people who either play an instrument or would like to play an instrument in an orchestra, and she finds that quite a lot of people in the area who do that, including airmen at the local airbase, and these are both British and American airmen. There are a lot of American airmen stationed in eastern England and elsewhere, of course, in England during
the
war.
Over the continent, over Germany, yeah.
That's right. It's very moving, you know, if you go to Cambridge, just outside Cambridge, there's a very large American military cemetery.
I've seen it, yes.
And as you drive past, you reflect on the bravery of those men. These were young men often taken from places that were very far from Europe, you know, boys from the Midwest, so to speak, coming over and responding tremendously bravely to the challenge, as did their British equivalents. And so she gets some of these people along, and they just play in this little orchestra in their spare time, and it's a sort of morale booster. And it works. People enjoy it. And it makes them realize one of the things they're fighting for. It makes a difference. And at one point, La reflects on how music can have that sort of role. Music can have a moral effect. It can remind us of beauty in particular, which is very important. The other group of people who become involved, well, one or two of them become involved, are Poles. And this is a
Poles, as in Poland, Polish emigres.
That's right, Polish emigres. And these men were tremendously brave. Their circumstances were perhaps even more difficult. The Polish Air Force managed to get out of Poland and ended up taking a very circuitous route to France, and then from France to Britain. And they fought with great distinction in the war. And one of the real tragedies, in my mind, is that these Polish airmen and Polish servicemen in general weren't ultimately treated particularly well, in that they saw their country being sold into the control of a country which had not been particularly positive towards them.
This is the Soviet Union after the war.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. And so this was an act of, in a sense, great treachery, or it was perhaps a cowardly act. And so Poland found itself a prisoner. And one of the most remarkable things that I found out when I was doing some research and general reading about the Polish servicemen was that at the end of the war, they weren't allowed to march in the victory parade through London.
Wow.
And this was because of the influence of the Soviet Union. Stalin
closing
was
it down
against
from
that.
Afar. Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And those brave men stood on the pavements at the side of the road and wept, as they saw everybody else doing that. And this was a tremendous injustice, which was eventually, really about 60 years later, set right when the British government invited Polish ex-servicemen to go and lay a wreath at a ceremony in London. I find that the most extraordinary, poignant story.
Your La falls in love with one of them in the new book, and we'll look at that. But we have so many listeners who want to speak with you. If I may, let's come back to the story. But let's invite in Mary in Lexington, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air.
Oh, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Mr. McCall Smith. It is such a pleasure to speak with you. My husband found through me Precious and Grace on HBO. Because I had been telling him about this wonderful series of books I had been reading.
These are the key figures in the number one ladies detective agency.
Yes, her name is Precious, and she is Precious. And
and strong.
She is enlightenment. When I'm driving down the road and there's traffic, I have her wisdom and her fully grounded in life. And they also were on HBO, and I implore Mr. McCall Smith to put them back on, because what a treasure. My whole family enjoyed it.
A half dozen episodes there, and will it be back? Do you know?
Not enough.
Well, Mary, thank you very much for your kind remarks there, and I'm really delighted that you're enjoying those characters. I thought that the television series which HBO put on was wonderful. They really captured the feel of the books, and those actresses did a tremendous job. Mm-hmm. Jill Scott and Annika Nonny Rose, who acted Precious Romanzi and Grace Micuzzi, they really brought them to life. So I was very pleased, and it would be wonderful if HBO did some more of those, and I hope they do.
Let's go to Deirdre in Columbia, South Carolina. Deirdre, you're on the air with Alexander McCall Smith.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Dr. McCall Smith, I just also wanted to thank you for the number one ladies detective novel books. They are, I find them to be very beautiful and very hopeful. Because all of the problems that we're used to hearing about in Africa and in the rest of the world are all there, sometimes highlighted, sometimes in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your characters remind us that the quality of the life that we live and our humanity is determined by the little decisions that we make every day. And it is possible to live a gentle, merciful life, even with great adversity. And thank you so much for that.
Well said.
Well, Thank you very much, Deirdre. Thank you for that. The problem is, of course, that we hear such bleak reports from Africa in the media generally, and of course the media is just doing their job in reporting difficulties, but that can make us forget that ordinary life continues and that there are people there in those difficult circumstances leading good ordinary lives. So thank you for that.
But do you feel sometimes as though you're prettying Africa up? I mean, I've, as a reporter, you know, worked through Rwanda, Congo, Somalia, some tough parts of Kenya. It's certainly not all tea cozies or even the kind of, you know, gentle, merciful moments that Deirdre wonderfully describes.
Yeah. Well, I think, yes, I see what you mean. I wouldn't for a moment deny the harsh realities of life in many sub-Saharan African countries. Those things exist. Of course they exist. And I've been to Rwanda, as have you, and I've seen, even today, you see the scars of the genocide there. You're confronted with the consequences of that. And there are terrible things which have happened. But the point that I'm making is that if we concentrate only on the terrible things that happen in a particular country or a particular part of the world, we pathologize whole cultures, whole countries, and we see them as just being places where that sort of thing happens. Mm. Now, you mustn't deny that that is happening, and I don't, and I do actually refer to these problems in the books. Mm-hmm. All that I'm saying is that in spite of that, people still lead these good lives, and there are things in those cultures which are very precious and very good. I think that we can look at those sub-Saharan African cultures and we can learn something from them. There's wonderful music. There are great human qualities.
Sure.
That's really what I'm saying. I'm just saying don't just take a one-sided view. So the sort of things that Deirdre mentioned there are there, and I'm very happy to draw attention to them.
Absolutely. John in Beaufort, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What do you know?
I just wanted to say to Mr. Smith, not only how much I enjoy his books and his HBO special, is that I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Zambia. And when I read these books and I see this HBO special, I just tell people how dead on it is, how it describes the people and the scenery. And it's just really spot on.
There you go. Affirmation from the front, Sandy.
Thank you, John. I'm sure that you must have very happy memories of your time in Zambia. That's a very lovely country in many respects. And thank you for saying that it's accurate. I hope that I managed to convey the nature of the people reasonably accurately. So thank you.
Tony in Danville, Kentucky, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello, Tony.
Hello. I'm interested in the World War II story.
Very good.
And particularly, I'm actually teaching a course next summer for American students on the British spirit and popular culture in World War II. And I'm curious about what Mr. Paul Smith thinks about the nostalgia for that period. Recently, Vera Lynn, the Dame Vera Lynn, has been top of the charts in Britain with a reissue of all her records from that wartime period.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that we in Britain are very connected to that period still?
Great question. Thank you, Tony.
That's fascinating, Tony. I find that a very interesting question. I think it's a response that people have to the conditions of their lives today. Now, to a certain extent, there can be a rather unbalanced nostalgia or unrealistic nostalgia, but which I think results from a misunderstanding of what life was really like. But when people do this and they look back and they sing those songs, they listen to that music, they like watching films of the period and so on, I think that what they're probably doing is expressing a deep felt concern they have over the loss of social cohesion in particular. I think people do feel that. People obviously have to adjust to a different sort of society. Every country experiences change, social change, and in the process of that, they may lose a certain amount of social cohesion, which they find precious for one reason or another. It's also a bit of a reaction, I think, in the United Kingdom, in particular, to a certain shabbiness of our public life. In this country, we've been, as you know, rather traumatized by disclosures as to the venality of politicians. And I think that people are reacting against that, and they're saying, well, here was a period where people had a more noble cause and where the moral rights and wrongs were very, very clear, and people all pulled together and had an opportunity to do something about it. So I think there are rather interesting issues of social psychology going on in the background. I think we could probably spend an awful lot of time analysing that. I'd like to attend your course, actually. It sounds very interesting.
Tony, thank you. Thank you for your call. I mean, right on the first page of your latest, Law's Orchestra Saves the World, we're headed back into that territory. We're in a drophead coupe, and we're driving down narrow lanes flanked by hedgerows, ancient farm boundaries, road signs made of heavy cast iron forged to last for generations of travelers. You know, very quickly, you yourself seem to me to, what, I don't know if play on is the right word, but certainly reference something to do with the nostalgia Tony's talking about here.
Yes, I do, in the sense that I probably would say that I experience some of that myself. I understand the feeling. And it's not just in this country. I'm sure that there are people in the United States who can look at a film of the period and they see examples, perhaps rather idealized behavior, and they say, oh, look how well people behaved, or look at how helpful they were to one another, and so on in that particular period. I mean, to a certain extent, it's a romanticizing of the past, but you can understand how it happens. As far as that first chapter is concerned, the business of driving down those roads, seeing those particular road signs and the hedgerows and the little fields, that actually very much reflects a trip which I made myself with a friend. I asked him, he lives in that part of the world, and I said, I want to go and take a look at some of the villages down there, because I hadn't been in that part of the world for years, and I wanted to refresh my memory about some of the villages that I'd stayed in and seen in the past. And we went off in this car, which was rather similar to the car described there, and we did that journey. It's realistic in the sense that I was there.
Cast iron road signs, that takes us back right away. You write, some conscientious hand had kept them freshly painted, their black lettering sharp and clear against chalk-white backgrounds, pointing to villages with names that meant something a long time ago, but which were now detached from the things to which they referred. And these, we just go back and make the names of long-forgotten yeoman families, of mounds, of the crops they grew, of the wild flora of those parts, garlic, cress, nettles, crosswort. Whew, and you take us,
yes.
We're on the Wayback Machine in a hurry right there on those hedgerows.
Well, it's all still there, you know. If you go to that part of Suffolk, you'll see it. It's all still there. You could go tomorrow and you'd see those signs and those roads.
How many minutes' drive is that out of London? Is it 2 hours and you're there?
You'd get there within 2 hours, yes, probably. Less than that, and then you'd be in that world.
It's a world that Alexander McCall Smith brings back powerfully in his new book, Law's Orchestra Saves the World. You may know him from his number one latest detective agency series, but he has many others, and we have callers on those as well, whether it's, I'll let them speak when we come back from a short break here. Alexander McCall Smith joins us from Edinburgh, Scotland. 60 titles in print, everything from medical ethics and law to Africa and the detective agency in Botswana. Here's native Botswana artist Stampore with a song featured in the HBO series, the number one latest detective agency. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Alexander McCall Smith, author of the number one Ladies Detective Agency series about life, Africa, music, war, and his new book, Las Orchestra Saves the World. It's set in World War II in Suffolk, a kind of a rural retreat in some ways from war, though the airmen are there, the war is there, but an amateur orchestra that maybe saves a little sanity, a little humanity, a very McCall Smith kind of theme. Alexander McCall Smith joins us from Edinburgh, Scotland. There's one point in the new book where La, your heroine here, is talking about music. She says Bach is for order and Mozart is for healing, and the town needs it. Go. Eine kleine Nachtmusik, and we're in the healing side of that equation with the Mozart. Is it important in your life, Alexander McCall Smith? Do you see it as that potent socially?
Yes, I think it is. I think music for many people is their principal route to a spiritual experience. People obviously can find spirituality in all sorts of ways. They can find it through religion, they can find it through art, and they can certainly find it in music. Music is talking to us at a very intimate level. It is saying something which the soul recognizes, whatever the soul may be. It really is a very direct way to an understanding of beauty and resolution. Well, not all music, of course, helps us in that way, but good music enables us to see beauty and to understand how our lives can be resolved. I think that there's a profound moral role that music plays, and most people experience that. They listen to the music they like, and it says something to them. It elevates them. It encourages them. It consoles them. Music has a great consoling role.
A little healing music there in a story set in World War II. Let's go to Fonce in Hopkinton, Rhode Island. Fonce, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
This is a delight to speak to Mr. Alexander McCall Smith, and I want to give him an opportunity to speak about his other series. I certainly hope that Lars will be the beginning in a long list, because I'm a reader of all the series. Has anyone tried the Scotland Street ones? The stories about Bertie, the poor gifted kid who has to survive an ambitious mother. And I started with Alexander McCall Smith because of a series called Irregular Portuguese Verbs.
Yes.
What a title for a book. So I hope Lars will only be the first of many, and I hope Mr. McCall Smith will speak a little bit about those other wonderful series, Isabel, Dalhousie, Bertie, the academic mayhem behind Irregular Portuguese Verbs. Can you say a few words about those other series?
Yes, well, thank you very much for that. And I'm delighted that you're enjoying those rather more obscure titles, such as the Van Eagleveld, the Irregular Verbs series. I'm going to write another book in that series. There were three. There was the first one, which you mentioned. There was The Finer Points of Sausage Dogs and At the Villa of Reduced Circumstances. And I'm at the moment writing volume four, in which poor Dr. Professor Dr. Van Eagleveld has all sorts of further humiliations. Scotland Street is going strong. There'll be a new volume in that series published in the United States very soon. And poor little Bertie, who is this much put upon six-year-old boy with a terrible mother problem. His mother problem, I'm very sorry to say, gets no better. It really is a pretty desperate situation. He's so looking forward to being 18 when he can leave home, but unfortunately, this is volume six, which I'm writing at the moment. He's remained six for the last 5 years.
You write three a year or something like that. How do you do that when at the same time you've been a professor of law and medical ethics? I mean, how on earth do you accomplish that?
Well, I stopped the day job. I think that was a choice that I had to make. I realized that I couldn't continue to write that number of books in my spare time. And so some years ago, I stopped being a professor. In fact, I became something called a professor emeritus, mm-hmm. which is a nice way of continuing but not having to do anything. So I'm now a full-time writer, and I write either 4 or 5 books a year, depending. And
it's still an astonishing volume. I mean, do you do them simultaneously? Are they sequential?
Well, I try to finish one before I start another, but this year I've been writing 2 at the same time because I've had 2 serial novels, a Scotland Street novel, and then a new series I've started called Corduroy Mansions. Volume mm-hmm. 2 in that new series has been running in the Daily Telegraph newspaper on their website in London at the same time as Scotland Street was being published in the Scotsman newspaper in Edinburgh. So I had 2 serial novels running at the same time and therefore had to write a chapter a day for each of them.
And you really do it that way, in the old Dickens style.
Yes.
As you write them, they appear the next day or something like it.
That's right. Wow. That's right. It's called Living Dangerously, and it really is. But it's tremendous fun because the readers can get in touch with me and tell me how they think the narrative should develop. And I take the suggestions very seriously, and on many occasions I say, yes, let's do it that way.
Oh, that's great. Let's get a call from California. Audrey in Hemet, California. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Tom. I would very much like to speak to Mr. McCall Smith and tell him how much I love his work, but especially about Edinburgh and Isabel Dalhousie. I feel as if I'm back home in Edinburgh when I go into the delis. And we went to Edinburgh last year, and we went to the little glass, what you call that place? G&T.
Glass and Thompson.
Yes, I was reliving the whole thing. We went to find 44 Scotland Street, but of course there's no number 44. So anyway, thank you. I just have loved your work. Thank you so much, Mr. McCall Smith.
Oh, well, thank you, Audrey. Thank you very much for calling. And let me get one more right here, if I may. Diane in Warner, New Hampshire. Diane, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. McCall Smith and Tom.
Hello, Diane.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say that I was I am so interested in the Isabel series from Edinburgh, and a friend of mine in Warner and I eagerly go to the library every time the latest one is in, and we have many interesting little philosophical discussions that spin off from Isabel's dilemmas. And what I like is that they are about real life, but not dark, and that's always an uplifting experience.
Diane, give us an example of a philosophical conversation that might, if you can recall one offhand, that might have been sparked by your reading with your friend here.
Well, most especially we discussed the issue of Isabel's pregnancy by her younger partner and her decision to keep that baby and carry through the pregnancy. And of course, that was kind of a blow at the end of the, I don't remember the title of that particular book, but it came right at the end, revelation of the pregnancy.
When you say her decision to keep it, now I haven't read this, was abortion an issue here? Or to give it, to put it up for adoption?
Well, it wasn't a major part of the book mm-hmm. or anything, but mm-hmm. it was raised at the end of that book, and just in I would say maybe an oblique way.
Mm-hmm. By also a professor of medical ethics, Alexander McCall Smith, what do you say to that moment? Is that one that you crafted to maybe spark that kind of conversation?
Well, Diane, you may be interested to hear that Isabel's pregnancy came as a surprise to me as well. This is one of the interesting things about writing novels, is that at the beginning of the novel you may have a general idea of what you think will happen in the novel, and then you get going, and lo and behold, all sorts of unforeseen events occur. That is, I think, because fiction is coming from the subconscious mind, which is busy making up its own plots, and you don't know that it's doing that. And so when Isabel found that she was pregnant I was really surprised as well. I was probably as surprised as you were when you read it. And of course, that pregnancy and then the subsequent birth of her little son Charlie in the books enables us to talk about a whole lot of other issues of bringing up children and so on in subsequent volumes. She's a person who really analyzes everything that happens to her. And of course, that's the rather interesting way of leading one's life, if one is attuned to the moral dilemmas which day-to-day life give rise to.
Diane, thank you very much for calling. Sue in Norton, Massachusetts. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Smith. It's a real honor to speak with you. I've read all your Mara Motswe and Isabel Dalhousie books, and I've noticed recently and over the years that you have moved away from traditional crime and mysteries to more subtle problems of ethics and morals and questions like that. I like this very much, but I'd like to know what moved you in that direction, and will you ever go back to traditional mysteries, and will Jamie and Isabel really get married?
Great. Thank you, Sue.
Well, Sue, thank you. In relation to your first question, I suppose there has been a bit of a move in that the very first number one ladies detective agency books did deal with one or two instances of criminal conduct, but we gradually moved away from that, and we just had Mara Motswe dealing with the problems in people's lives. And that, I think, actually probably reflects what life is largely about. We do have a certain amount of crime happening about us, but actually, really, for most people, experience of crime is relatively rare. And certainly, if you look at the traditional mystery, you'll see that every traditional mystery has one or two bodies. And the murder rate in some of these places where these mysteries are set must be absolutely horrific, you know, really quite unrealistic. I think maybe the mystery novel or the crime novel, detective novel, call it what you will, should perhaps start dealing with day-to-day crimes such as parking offences. Can't you imagine it? the detective is concerned with parking offences and very minor offences like that. Jamie and Isabel, that's really interesting. Now, I'm about to start writing a Volume 7 in that series. In fact, next week, I think I'll start putting pen to paper,
wow,
metaphorically, with that. And I don't want to give any spoilers. I don't really want to say what's going to happen, probably because I'm not 100% sure what is going to happen. I hope that Jamie marries Isabel. I think they should get married, put it that way. So I'm supporting that. Rest assured that I want them to get married, but I'm not entirely in control.
There you have it, straight from the author who denies control. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Carol, you're on the air.
Hi, and I want to thank Mr. McCall Smith for his body of wonderful work. I have been touched by his books. In fact, I want him to know that recently I did a big house cleaning and I got rid of a lot of books, a lot of good books, but I kept his book.
There you go. They made the cut.
And I want to congratulate him for his sense of public civility in his books. I worry that, like many others, about the coarsening of American society and of American speech. And I just hope that the public civility that is exhibited in his books would get better hold here in the United States. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Carol. How about it? You've got that tremendous civility. On the other hand, you know, we were talking not so long ago with Irvin Welsh out of your Scotland. Train Spotting is a completely different, rough and rugged themes of urban Scottish life.
Well, yes. Carol, thanks for keeping the books, by the way. I very, very much appreciate that. You're right about the coarsening of society. Our public life has become very coarsened. There's a lot of rudeness and aggression. There always was rudeness and aggression, of course, but somehow we seem to see a growth in that, and I think we're probably right about that. I think that this is worrying, because I think ordinary civility towards other people is one of the basic building blocks of a good society, of a moral and considerate society. And if we stop being civil to other people, then I think that is indicative of a cast of mind which will ultimately lead to a greater degree of social dissolution and social unhappiness. Tom, your point about urban Scottish life being
heroin
tough,
culture, down and out, not all nicely civil and mannered.
Sure, yeah, that's there. That's there everywhere. Yeah. And it's not just in Scottish cities. Any city has that. Mm-hmm. And you get different parts of cities and you get different circles in cities. All that I would say is that literature should be a broad church and it should actually reflect that aspect as well as other aspects. The problem is that we've become so used to entertaining ourselves with violence and bleakness that we forget that there are alternatives and that there's a rather more civil alternative life as well.
Well, we're taken back once more to World War II with Law's Orchestra in struggling and succeeding in maintaining some civility, some kind of aesthetic elegance, even in the midst of war. You take us back and plant it there. Do you think it was there even at the time? Are you making an oasis that didn't exist or perhaps did?
No, I think it existed. I think it existed. I think one has to be very careful about romanticizing the past. One has to be very careful about assuming things which might not have been there. But I think that there's plenty of evidence that there was cheerfulness and good humor and that there was courage. And that that people rose to the occasion, and we see that even in our own times, people rise to the challenge, and they discover things within themselves that they didn't know were there.
Alexander McCall Smith, author of the number one ladies detective agency series, among, as we have heard, many others. His new book is Law's Orchestra Saves the World. He joined us today from Edinburgh, Scotland. Mr. McCall Smith, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom.
Wonderful to have you with us. We'll close with Botswana's pop music sensation V, featured in the number one ladies detective agency series on HBO. Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sunday night, I see me.